Each week, we speak about how money is made and spent in the golf industry. Today, we're going to talk about that, but also examine the areas that aren't getting as much attention, but should be. Stay tuned. This is the business of golf. Welcome back to the Business of Golf. I am Allison Johnson here with my co-host, Adam Grubb. Adam, we've been talking a lot over our past shows and just in our conversations about the boom in golf right now across all of the different areas. So teaching and products and tournaments, and there's so much going on and there's such an influx of golfers and money into the industry. I mean, it's just been incredible.
Yeah, it's fun to see. But what I think is even more impressive are the amount of people that are behind the scenes that are helping this boom. And it's not just the players, it's not just the golfers, but there's this entire industry that most people don't know how it gets done, right? They don't know how these instructors become instructors and how that process. They don't realize all of the people that are behind the scenes that are making golf golf. And bringing this incredible sport to us every day. And our guest today is one of those people, and she's been doing it for a long, long time. And she has an entire history of change and being a pioneer and being one of only a few people to do things. I'm very excited to talk to Susie Whaley here in a second.
That's exactly right. So Susie Whaley, I am geeking out a little bit because as a woman in the space, you know, I remember when she played at the Greater Hartford Open against the men, and I was just a few years into my golf career, and it was very, very exciting and empowering and something I didn't even know could happen. So I am very excited. I'm going to actually read her bio because I don't want to miss anything that she's accomplished, and she's a super rock star. So we're just going to bear with me for a second. Susie Whaley is the PGA Director of Instruction for the Country Club at Mirasol in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. After serving 2 years as PGA Secretary and 2 years as Vice President, Whaley was elected as the PGA of America's first female president at the 2018 PGA annual meeting. She steered the association through the onset of the global pandemic, leading to the establishment of the nearly $8 million Golf Emergency Relief Fund for golf industry professionals in need and an unprecedented growth in rounds played using social distancing protocols established in conjunction with the CDC and Back to Golf. Recognized as one of golf's top 100 teachers in America, and with the Metropolitan Golf Association's Distinguished Service Award in 2019, Whaley's resume includes numerous other teaching awards: Golf Digest Top 50 Instructor, LPGA Top 50 Instructor, 2-time Connecticut PGA Teacher of the Year, 10-time Golf Digest State Teacher of the Year, and U.S. Kids Golf Master Kids Teacher. She is a 5-time PGA Junior League Championship Finals coach and has instructed more than 300 children to collegiate golf. Previously, she enjoyed a 5-year tenure at the Jim Flick Golf Schools before becoming the head professional at Blue Fox Run in Avon, Connecticut in 2002. From 2004 to 2006, she worked as an LPGA golf commentator for ESPN and began her own instruction and coaching business, Susie Whaley Golf, after ESPN. Susie, welcome in. I am so thrilled to have you here this morning.
Oh, it's great to be here. Good morning.
Susie, some of the things that Allison just said, does that even surprise you? Do you remember all of those accolades and all those great things? Because that was a lot.
I do remember all those things. But it also reminds me that I'm experienced now. I'm not going to say my age, but that I'm experienced. So that is also, I'm going to look at that as a positive.
You should. You should.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Susie, as a teacher and a playing professional, an industry leader and a mom of girls and a niece who are now entering the space as players and competitive players, you've experienced so much. But I have to ask, I need to know what it was like to play on the PGA Tour against the guys and being amongst the very first to do that.
Yeah, and that was a while back, right? But I remember it honestly like it was yesterday. My kids were really little. They were 8 and 6 when I did that. I was working full-time, as you mentioned, as a head golf professional. My husband was working full-time. And in the meanwhile, I was just going to try to play against, you know, the best male golfers in the world in front of 40 million people. And you know, people were like, what do you mean you're not going to play? Like, why would you make that decision? You know, and all I can say is I'm so thankful social media was not a thing in 2003, because I can only imagine the what I would have seen on social in regards to that. But I loved participating in it. I had an unbelievable amount of support. My team at work took over, you know, most of my responsibilities so I could practice and play. I was working out 3 hours a day, first thing in the morning, for 4:30 in the morning to try to get in the best physical shape I could. I wanted to play well. And when I teed it up on that first tee, you can only imagine the nerves. I mean, anybody has nerves in their first, you know, even let's just say you're just playing with a new group. You've just joined on a golf course and you want to hit that good. You want to hit the first shot, right? You don't want to embarrass yourself. Well, you know, multiply that by the world watching and women's golf on your shoulders. And, you know, you think, okay, well, you know, no big deal. Please, God, let the ball get in the air. And when it did, I pop flyed at center field, and it was like I'd hit it like Bryson, right? So, I was like, oh, my gosh, it went in the air. Let's go. I three-putted the first hole from 4 feet, literally. I thought I was going to be there all day. And I was – by the time I got to the green, I just was so nervous. I couldn't even see. And my caddy, Michelle McGann's dad, a dear friend, he said, it's your turn, Susie. And I said, well, no, I don't think I'm going to putt right now. And he said, no, it's definitely your turn. I went over and I put the ball down and I hit the putt and missed it by 5 feet. And I walked back toward Bucky and he goes, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm going to stand here for a second. He goes, no, it's still your turn. I went back over. I missed that one. And I really thought I was going to be there all day. So when that ball went in on the first hole, I looked like a reporter said to me, how could you possibly look like Cinderella at the ball after making double bogey from 4 feet on the first hole? And I was like, are you kidding? I thought I was going to make a 10. Six was amazing. And you know, it was the best thing that could have happened because I relaxed. I could laugh about it with my caddy and say, gosh, I don't even know what that was, but let's go. And I played the best round of golf from there on, I think, in my career. Not score-wise, but for the yardage I was playing and the circumstances I was under, I super proud of the way I played. So it was an amazing 2 days where I was accepted by most of the PGA Tour professionals. They knew why I was there. They knew it was an opportunity that I had to show my daughters that I would take the risk. I would work my tail off to be as prepared as I could and hold my head high, no matter the outcome. And I ended up beating a few of them, which was even better.
At the age your daughters were at the time, do you wish they were a little bit older to fully appreciate what was happening with their mom and how you were doing that? Or were you happy that they were in that kind of young, innocent age of like, oh, mom's going to go play golf again with some, in their mind, mom's going to play golf. But do you wish that they were a little older to fully comprehend what you were accomplishing?
Yeah, you said it perfectly. My daughters were just used to me playing with men. You know, I was a member of the PGA of America, but every week I played in a local event against men. And so it wasn't, you know, they knew there was something going on because there was constantly cameras at my house and I was constantly doing interviews and they were being picked up by at school from friends, which they loved, right? They got to go on play dates every day. So, you know, their perception of what was going on was, oh yeah, my mom's going to play in this cool golf tournament. And I don't think I was as advanced in your thinking. You know, for me, I didn't think about that. I just knew my daughters who made me finally decide to say yes. My oldest, who was 8 at the time, we were reading a story and she asked, it was about opportunity and being brave and taking risk. And she looked right at me and asked me why I wasn't playing. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to play. And this was in the end of November. I had qualified in September. And I still hadn't said yes. And I walked downstairs and I said to my husband, we're in. Jen, we just read this story and I told her how important all that was and she called me out. so we're in. And so when your 8-year-old calls you out, there's no turning back. And now, you know, she may remember it mostly from pictures, but my daughters are both accomplished golfers, both of them played Division I golf. My oldest now plays corporate golf and my youngest is trying to play, aspiring to be on the LPGA tour. She has some Symetra status, but she fully comprehends, not in the moment, but she's played that golf course with me from the tips, and she is incredulous now, and she says, I can't believe you actually hit it from back here and made a par, you know? So it's fun to think about it. It's fun to go back over it, but I do think my daughters, over time, got the full grasp of it and they get it. They get the fact that, you know, you're not always going to win. But it's all about just putting yourself out there, even when it's way out of your comfort zone. And neither of my daughters are afraid to fail. And I credit some of that to playing in the GHO.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, you inspired not only your daughters, but so many others in the industry. You and I recently had a conversation where you educated me, and I appreciate it very much. And I want to bring that conversation up here, because I think that right now there's a lot of talk, as you just brought up, your daughters wanting to play with Symetra and LPGA. And one of the things that came up during the pandemic was that the women on the LPGA tour were being able to play in qualifying tour events as well as Symetra tour events. And my take on that was, hold on. That shouldn't be happening. That's like a Yankees player going down and playing AAA. And how does that impact that lower tour, the feeder tours and those women who are already on the tour taking that playing spot? And, you know, we all know there's such an incredible disparity of playing opportunities to begin with for the girls, that those are really valuable spots. And so when I said that to you, you were like, hold on, you don't have the full picture. So I'd love to have that conversation, because I think that it is eye-opening and important. And it just, you know, there's so much going on in the sport. I think it's a really interesting topic.
Yeah. And you can imagine where I sit, right? It's personal for us. I have a daughter desperately trying to get opportunity to tee it up. And so, you know, you weren't wrong. It doesn't feel right. When you have an LPGA tour member who has full status playing on the Cactus Tour or the WAPT Tour or the Symetra Tour, all of which are running incredible opportunity for women's golf. You think for a second and go, why is that? Why are you doing that and taking away this opportunity for the younger players? However, you know, I look at it a little differently. I think what the world needs to acknowledge and realize in the business space of the game is that women's golf does not have the opportunity. And during COVID, as a global tour, the LPGA literally, I don't want to say shut down because that's unfair. They worked tremendously hard to provide opportunity. But there was nowhere for the LPGA tour players to make a living. They don't have, and I'm generalizing because I certainly don't know each and every individual's deals or sponsorship arrangements, but they don't have the kind of backing that a PGA Tour player has to survive a year of no revenue. They're not employees of the LPGA. They are independent contractors. They do not get a salary like many other sports do to be on a team or to be a competitor in the space. What they earn is what they make. If they don't play, there is no paycheck coming into the house. If they're not preparing for that one or two LPGA tour events that are coming, all of us that play the game know you can't just tee it up and hope to play your best. You have to prepare before that to play your best. So I fully understand why an LPGA tour player would want to get reps in, would want to go to the Cactus Tour. It's not just to play better. It's to make a living. It's to put food on the table. That sounds dramatic, but in the LPGA Tour, it's just fact. It's fact for the Symetra Tour players. It is incredibly expensive to play. It's $500 an entry fee. The Korn Ferry Tour, I think, is $100 or $200 an entry fee. The WAPT and the Cactus Tour, they don't have the sponsorships that these men's tours have. And so it's pay to play. And those entry fees are covering most of those purses without, you know, disrespect to sponsors that are supporting those tours, which thank you for those that are. But I think you have to look at it from all sides. And you have to realize that when you're looking at the PGA Tour average salaries versus the LPGA Tour average salaries, when I think it's 72% less, and you look at the pay gap in the United States, which is just an 82% differential, we're sorely behind in the women's game, far greater than an 82% pay equity, which is even, that's horrible in itself. But it's worse for women's golf. And so, you know, I always say to my daughter, if you were on the LPGA Tour, you would be playing. You would be playing to make money. And so don't condemn those that are trying to earn a living. You just need to play better. So it's a little harsh in my house. It's just fact. And I look forward to a day where the LPGA Tour players play the LPGA Tour. I do. So I'm not saying that I'm hopeful. I certainly am hopeful that day comes sooner than later. But for today and where we are in 2021, I get it.
Susie Whaley is a guest here on Business of Golf on the Stick and Act Podcast Network. Susie, there is this PGA world that you know, and there's the PGA world that a sticker hack that is the amateur middle of the road golfer knows. And those are two very different items, right? The PGA that we know is that it's this group of people that help golf be golf, and that there's a PGA instructor who is going to charge me $80 to tell me I can't hit an 8-iron 160 yards. Awesome. Well, maybe I got a deal. So tell us the real story of the PGA and who they are, what they represent, and why they're so important to the game of golf.
So you're spot on. So there's the PGA Tour, which is what you see, you know, the easiest way to describe it is what you see on television and digital week in and week out. Have a championship week in and week out. Those are the players who are actually competing on course to make a living and doing it in a way that's offering all of us this wonderful experience that we get to watch and be a fan of. And then there's the PGA of America. The PGA of America is the industry division. We are 29,000 professionals. We are the largest sports association in the world, many of whom played on tour, whether it be the PGA Tour or the LPGA Tour, and have then chosen to go on the industry side. We're an $84 billion industry, which includes manufacturers and facilities. So, you know, oftentimes the PGA of America, many people just think of a teacher or a coach, which is what I love, and that's what I'm passionate about. But there's also business operators and owners across the country that work within the game. People who work in television and digital are PGA professionals. So if you think of the game as an entirety, as a business entity, most of the time there's a PGA professional involved in every space of that entity and every stakeholder in that entity. But our mission is really to grow the game. It's to grow the game and to serve the people that wear our logo, which is the PGA of America logo. So we also, which gets confusing to the consumer, own and operate the Ryder Cup alongside of Ryder Cup Europe, the PGA Championship, the KitchenAid Senior PGA Championship, and the KPMG Women's PGA Championship alongside the LPGA and KPMG. So we also have these four incredible championships that fund what we do, which is education and employment, player development, coaching and teaching for those that are members of our association. So we're both nonprofits, the PGA Tour and the PGA of America, or a 501c6 and a 501c3. And then we also have this incredible foundation space that is really aimed at changing the face of the game, whether it be amongst junior golfers, whether it be amongst diversity and people from a different background. We're offering a place to play now, which is access at municipal golf courses that are trying to close that we want to reinvigorate and open. And then we have PGA Hope, which is our veterans mission to get veterans the ability to learn the game of golf, be together, find a safe haven in the game through equipment and coaching that our foundation covers.
So right now, in coming, you know, hopefully towards the tail end of this pandemic, as people get vaccinated and all that kind of good stuff, I have at least 15 to 20 conversations a week in my business life about how do we keep people engaged in golf? How do we bring new people into the sport? And I'm curious as to your take on it. You know, we've talked for years now about pace of play and how do we make the game run faster? We've talked about, you know, ready golf. We've got conversations and, you know, all kinds of stuff to bring new people into this space from different backgrounds. What do you think is going to really make the next 10 years of this game and this industry continue to keep the momentum rolling forward?
Well, the pandemic, you know, with certainly respecting anybody that suffered from COVID, because it's been a harsh year for everyone. What's really come out of that is women's sports has elevated and the voice in women's sports has elevated, which is incredibly exciting. And then golf. And so we were up 14% year over year. That's the first time I think that's happened since 2007. We're up 600,000 juniors, 50 million more rounds in 2020 than in 2019. And when you look at that data, it's pretty impressive. I think those of us that are in the game and in the leadership of the game and in the business of the game, what you're really looking forward at is how do we keep them? And, you know, the game of golf has struggled. We, you know, every year we announce, oh, we had 1 million more women come join us in the game. And then in small print, it says, but we have 1 million that left, right? And enough with the small print. Like, I'm at a point in my career that why is that? Why does that continue to happen? And I realize, look, you can't be Pollyanna. People's lives get in the way. Family, health, work. And I understand the need to step away if you need to for those circumstances. But to lose that many when after this particular year, certainly those of us that are in the business don't want to see that happen. So what do we need to do differently moving forward? Because this is not a new conversation. We've had this, you said that, we've had this conversation since I've been in the business. And I think those of us that are female in the business, not that I haven't always been tired of it, but not now. I just am experienced, as I said in the beginning, right? And now, like, I want to see some real action. I want to see some data and some metrics of where we're starting. What are the intentional steps we're going to take to change it? And where are the metrics at the end of that? So that we can actually deal with this as a business. Because I am a huge believer in the invitation to the game, whether it be for women, men, anybody from a diverse background, anybody from a different sexuality, whatever it might be, different religion, it doesn't matter. I want everybody to play the game. But how are we tracking that, and where are our failings, and how can we fix it? And for me, it's got to be, the conversation has to be about the revenue of the game. It has to be about the business of the game. We keep coming at this as it's the right thing to do, to invite women to the game. But women own 51% of the wealth in this country. They have 57% of the college educations in this country. Their money, in my opinion, is just as green as any guy that walks in the door. And facilities need to wake up and pay attention to that. And I'm not here to say that some aren't doing an incredible job of that, because they are. But what's happening is, in my opinion, is if women and men have tons of choices in their worlds. After their work day or their family day, there's only X amount of time. And how are we that choice? And how are we going to continue to be that choice for that person who has multiple other choices? If we're not offering an experience that makes whomever's walking through that door feel like their money is valued and respected, and that their time spent there is an experience that they want to cherish and do again, we are going to lose them. So we have to look at this as a business case study moving forward. We cannot continue to say we want women to play. We want people from a diverse background to play. It's how are we going to encourage the experience to make them feel part of that community, whether it be from setup of golf courses, whether it be of what they're allowed to come attired as, we have to stop the barriers to entry. And the barriers to entry are things like when you're learning the game, you're hitting a little white ball with a very little club face, and off a uneven surface, right? And then we're going to say, but just go have fun, right? Just go have fun. You're going to enjoy this, right? After you have X amount of shots. Oh, by the way, you have to wear the right outfit. Don't play your music. And, you know, I'm giving you the scenarios of some facilities. Many facilities have made these changes. But why not open those barriers and get rid of some of them? Why not allow people to wear a great athletic outfit and feel comfortable going out and playing golf in sneakers? I'm a huge traditionalist of the game. I love the rules. I love the juniors I coached to have their shirt tucked in and a belt on and their hat forward. Okay, that's just me. But if I have a child that shows up in soccer shorts and sneakers and a soccer jersey, great. Please join us. But I want them to see the players who are now elite. And those kids copy, right, as they progress through the game. We need to stop worrying about that entry level. Just let them come, let them show up, let them learn it, let them love it, and then let them be immersed in it because it's a business prospect for facilities, for revenue, for rounds played, for food, for coaching, for the industry. And that's where we are today. And for us to continue that 50 million round surge, we better maintain it because those are the rules that were lax. And people loved it. And we better pay attention to that.
Susie, that's an incredible answer. I think one of the things that is exciting is that there are local clubs and there are courses that are hearing that message. And they are either being led by women internally or they are being led by men who understand and have that sense that we need to keep the women in the game. One of those things and what we do at our club is the couples golf, which I know it's a Friday night. It's once a month or once every, 6 weeks or so, but it is just it's a party. It's a party at the golf course. And it's an opportunity for my wife and I to go without our kids and be with other people and other couples. That's how she started really trying to play better. She was always athletic, but really starting to try to play better and then go play on her own was because of that night. And the couples golf was, every hole is a different rule. And of course there's drinking, God forbid. But it's this kind of experience. And I think that's what she really enjoys. The, you know, going out at 9 a.m. and playing with old Betty isn't exactly her idea of fun, but going out for the experience of golf and having that was. Do you see things like that happening at a local level with these clubs? And where does that shift and change start with, hey, this is a fun experience?
I think it has to shift in the culture, right? The culture from the second you step on the property to the second you leave, right? So some of those things that I would like to see shift, which have yet to shift, are, you know, if there's one female on the property from an employee standpoint, meaning in the golf operation, then they're good, right? That's absurd. You know, if you have one female instructor and nine male instructors, you're good. Women need to see women on the property working, being employed, enjoying the game for them mostly. And again, a huge generalization. There's plenty of women that would go if there were any women. But a lot of people want to see themselves in the facility where they're spending their money. And so if there aren't women on the staff, if there's not women helping you navigate the game, if there isn't a women's group, it doesn't mean you have to be a part of it. But if there's not that when you go to a facility, I antenna up. If there aren't pitchers in the food and beverage area of females enjoying the game, and there's only trophies and the hardest hole on the golf course up on the wall, I don't know how that's incredibly inviting to a new player. Most of the women that see those pictures look at me and go, I have to play that hole? Well, I can't play here. Are you showing fun and social on the walls? Do you have a women's locker room where they can actually change? Or is it a bathroom stall where there's not even a hook to hang their purse or their shirt to change for dinner? Many facilities are doing amazing work and have made unbelievable progress. So I don't want to make it sound like they haven't. But we have a long way to go, or our numbers would look very different. And, you know, if you're doing a walkthrough and thinking about playing at a public facility, 75% of the courses across the country are public, and the others, obviously, resort or private or municipal. And at the end of the day, if you're thinking about a place to spend your money and you happen to be a woman, I would certainly take a keen eye as to what that facility's culture is. Who's answering the phone? Who's answering your questions? Is there an opportunity for you to learn? Is there an opportunity where you're new and you can be a part of a group immediately? Or do you have to take 45 lessons before you even get invited to go out on the golf course? They're just questions to ask. And I think where we fail is women don't know those questions. Right? They're assuming, like any other business, they're going to be catered to when they walk through that door. And when it doesn't happen, they think, oh, I guess this is the way golf is. No, no. Go find another facility to spend your money, because there's plenty of them that want your business and will respect the value of the experience for you and with you and partner with you through that. So I'm just a huge advocate in that space. And I don't mean to make it gender, right? It's the same for men on the other side. If you're not feeling like your money is valued, or you don't have a voice in the community where you choose to spend your money, there's plenty of others that you can go to. But what I find is people typically leave. They walk with their feet thinking that this is a golf culture, when in fact it's a facility culture.
So when someone wants to get into the game, Susie, what do you recommend they do? How do they find where to go? Man, woman, child, how do you find the right facility?
Again, something we tackled over the last 6 years in my tenure with the PGA of America, because I don't think it was easy. Get Golf Ready was a very popular program at the PGA of America, which was a new player development program, 5 lessons, find your facility, type in a zip code, and you could start the game that way. And it was a strong component of many new players, male and female, coming to the game. But as we progressed through it, people wanted to know what the next steps were. Okay, I got into it now. What do I do now? And there was really a gaping hole there, unless the facility itself that was offering this business prospect of 5 lessons had a next step built and planned out for these people. So some of them left. So when we took over the rights to PGA.com 2 years ago, we are now building, COVID stalled us, but we're building this digital platform to do just what you're talking about, kind of an open table for golf, where we are inviting communities and companies and PGA professionals to be on this digital platform to be able to speak to the consumer directly. We've never done that at the PGA of America. We've never sent, you know, from business to consumer to people, because we always thought, well, we don't want to promote one PGA professional over the other, and realized very quickly, what in the world are we doing? You know, we're the largest sports organization in the world with the best coaches in the world. Why in the world aren't we connecting consumers to our coaches? And that's what we've started. So that's on PGA.com. You can go to PGA.com. You can find a coach. You can find a facilities profile and all the programming that they're offering near you. The caveat to that is we only have 1,800 PGA professionals currently with profiles because of COVID. And so that's in a build out. You know, as I've said multiple times, we have 29,000. So you can imagine people would go on and be a little disappointed if they didn't find something in their area. Hopefully they'll be patient with us and understand that we're in the process of that. But we're hoping that's the one-stop shop for somebody that wants to start the game. And then the LPGA, which I'm also a member of, the Teaching and Club Professional Division, they have an LPGA site that's trying to do the same. So there are opportunities where people can learn the game, be a part of the game. We also purchased 2 years ago a company called Next Gen Golf. The PGA of America purchased Next Gen Golf. And Next Gen Golf is kind of a millennial, cool golf group that I am such an advocate of and was so excited to have our association purchase. It started as club golf in the college space. Chris Hart is the founder of that from Boston. And he built out this club golf model because he really didn't have a place when he went to college, not as a Division I or II, III athlete, but he still wanted to compete and play golf. And he realized there just wasn't enough opportunity. So he started that, which has now turned into city tours all across the country. So for example, my daughter, who's now working in Boston, has met people through Next Gen Golf where she can go play with them, new golfers, good golfers, tournament golfers. There's all sorts of options. It's really for, you know, I don't want to label it as 40 and under because Chris would, you know, not be thrilled with me, but it's really that younger cohort where you want to be with your peers. You want to be kind of in a fun nine hole, have a beer if that's what you like, or an iced tea, whatever your choices are, after golf and after work. And that has been explosive. That's even turned into now a national club championship in Pinehurst, North Carolina, for any club champion of any club across the country. And it's a really cool, cool website. So go to Next Gen Golf if you're in that age group. Even if you're not, check it out because it's an unbelievable business model that's making a huge difference in that space.
You're an incredible speaker. I love listening to you. Allison, you know, this is one of those guests where I wish we had 2 hours because there's so sure. so much there to unpack, but there's probably so much more experience, right? Experienced, or what's the word you're using? Yeah. Okay. Experience to pour out. So Susie, a pleasure and an honor to have you on the Business of Golf here.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. It was great talking with you, and we really appreciate your time.
You too. Have a great day.
Well, that was certainly everything I had hoped for and more. What a great conversation.
Yeah, it was. And that's the type of leadership that I hope more people see. And I didn't know, there was a lot of things she said there that I had no idea. I didn't realize that it was the largest sports organization and association in the world. I didn't realize that they had plans and programs that were already in place and for some of these, from a growing the game perspective. But what I was most excited to hear was that she did have an understanding and that the PGA has an understanding that there are barriers in the game and they are doing things and trying things because they probably don't get enough credit there. And she said at the very beginning, we think, and I say we, the Sticks and Hacks and the amateurs, we think of the PGA of, oh, every weekend someone's going to play for $2 million. Cool, right? And we get to watch that on TV. There's an entire organization, an association that is behind the scenes building the sport for the long term. And that's awesome.
For sure. And one of the things, you know, these conversations have been happening for a very long time. We had Golf 2020 launched over a decade ago. I mean, there have been a multitude of efforts, but in the past, it was all very siloed, in my opinion. So USGA would have a program and the PGA of America would have a program. And then there'd be all these other pop-up organizations regionally from other people and competing charities and all kinds of stuff. Because everybody's very passionate about the game and the business of golf. And we all want the people that don't know how great it is to come into our golf circle and learn how golf is not only a lot of fun, but opens up all these doors from a business perspective. And you have this universal language wherever you go once you're a golfer. And so the passion has always been there. I think over the past few years, we've had an opportunity to be like, hold on a second. If we all work together, all boats rise with the tide, right? We need to all be moving this together, forward together for it to truly take hold and work. And as we are creating these platforms, I mean, that's a phenomenal platform the PGA is putting out. Everybody else should be amplifying that too, instead of being like, oh, they did that, we should go create our own, right? Because it exists. Let's use that and all move forward together with that platform and getting people introduced to the right instructor and all that kind of good stuff. And then what other areas of focus do we have where we could all work together to push that boat forward? And so I, for me, you know, in being in this industry for a long time and it really changing dramatically since I first got into the sport, this is a really pivotal time. And we either keep these people engaged in the sport or we continue to see them leave because they're not welcomed. And that's really it in a nutshell. Either we do the right thing now and make this work for the game and the industry as a whole, or we're going to keep having these conversations another 20 years.
And Allison, I will say this, and hopefully this isn't controversial, because that's not exactly what I'm about. I've never been told that I was controversial because I'm from Indiana. But more specifically,
New Jersey, I'll tell you if you are.
I will tell you that it's not just that point is not just for women. That right. point is for the beginners. That point is for everybody right. starting the game, because there's so much there. So many people that want to spend money, want to play golf, want to start their own leisure activity because they can't hunt, they can't fish, they don't do household chores and housework. You know, I'm speaking specifically of myself.
Avoidance? Are you saying golf is an opportunity for avoidance?
Yeah, if I'm going to have to paint the outside of the house, I'd rather go play golf. But there's that part of it too. All these beginners and these people that young, old, there are people that start the game at 65 years old. And how do we keep them in there? So more conversation to be had, but a great show, Allison. And again, Susie Whaley, the guest, just incredible. If you don't know much about her, go look her up and go follow her and be a part of what she's doing for golfers all across the country. It's amazing.
Absolutely. All good things here at the Stick and Hack Network. And thanks for joining us at the Business of Golf. And we'll see you next week.